Thank you very much. Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me all right in the back? Okay, thanks. I get a big kick out of coming to this group. You need to take some tranquilizers before you come here. But other than that, it's a hell of an experience. But enthusiasm is such a powerful word, and that certainly that captures the spirit of this group. It's really wonderful. I was thinking that next year we're going to have the International Convention celebrating AA's 80th year. And I'm old enough so that when I was born, there was no AA. And alcoholics didn't really have a chance. They really didn't. Throughout history, they would end up in mental institutions or committing suicide, jails or whatever, but there wasn't any hope for them. There really wasn't. And along came Bill Wilson, who in a hospital had a very powerful spiritual experience. And from that came this whole thing. It's like that moment was the big bang of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's interesting to think about that, because you can either say that that explosion occurred 80 years ago, or you could say it's still happening. And I like to think that it's still happening. We're still experiencing the energy of that night. And this is passed on from one alcoholic to another. And it's designed so that each alcoholic has a chance to have that same experience. That transforming experience where you suddenly realize that your perspective and perception of everything was way off. Way off. And that this world is just marvelous compared to what we thought. But in order to see it, you have to have the transformation. Or as Chuck Chamberlain said, the new pair of glasses. Where somebody hands you these glasses, and when you look through them, you see another dimension to your own life and to the world and everything. Kind of like those three-dimension glasses. Remember the movies they had? And you'd end up ducking because the ball was coming at you and all that. And so I feel very fortunate to encompass all of AA's history in my own life. I got sober in December of 1964. And that's also Pearl Harbor Day. And my sponsor got sober on August 6th, which is Hiroshima Day. And he told me that our lives had something to do with getting bombed. And so in any event, I thought it was a great time to live when I was born, because the country was coming out of a depression, and who knows how long it would have taken if the Japanese didn't attack us. But once they did, we were in the war of all wars, and the country knew that they had to unite, or there was a good chance we wouldn't win this war. And so everybody was on the same team. It was just great. Everybody was eager to sacrifice for a common cause. And I remember my mother was an air spotter up in Connecticut. And she had times that she went up on the tallest hill in the town and radioed in any airplane that flew over. And the submarines were, of course, on the East Coast. The Germans had their submarines out there for a lot of the war, especially in the beginning. So a lot of ships were sunk because we just didn't take it seriously yet. And they left the lights on in New York City, and the ships were silhouetted against that. And the submarine just sat there going, wow, this is the easiest target I've ever seen. And so we finally took it even more seriously and got blackouts and all of that. So I was 10 or 11 when this started. And all my relatives went in the military, just about everybody. And if you didn't do that, you went into a defense plant. And everywhere you can imagine, there were factories building airplanes and tanks and guns and all that stuff. And I saw a picture of Firestone out in Akron with his son. And they were building the 20 millimeter cannons that you put on ships to shoot down airplanes. And we think of him as producing rubber tires, but during the war, they really had a great deal more that we were involved in. And my uncle was a pilot in the Air Force. And I remember when he came home, he was a bomber pilot in Europe, and those guys didn't have long life expectancies. But I remember when he came home and he had his uniform on, he had those wings, and it was so exciting. And I said, I wonder if someday I'll grow up and be a pilot like him. Well, I did, but when I got the wings and finally got promoted to captain, which is where he was, I looked in the mirror and I said, they sure don't make captains like they used to. Because my opinion of myself was so low that I couldn't take credit for anything. I just, like alcoholics with low self-esteem. And so anyway, I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, and we had a lot of defense plants. Winchester Rifle was there. And when the war ended, we came into the 50s. It was just amazing because the plants all started making automobiles. They didn't make many automobiles in the 40s. I think they stopped in 46. So there's no such thing as a 48 Ford. If somebody wants to sell you one, tell them they didn't make them that year. And so there was a GI Bill. There was the cars of the 50s. I think they're the coolest looking cars that have ever been built. So there was this great excitement in the country, and there was it was a great time to live. Unfortunately, I was an alcoholic, and I wasn't going to enjoy any of this. Just like you didn't enjoy whatever era you grew up in. My greatest fear was other people. And they were all over the place, so I was always running into them. You couldn't avoid them. They were just, you know. And somehow I knew that I was inferior to all these people. And it was my job to not let them find out. So you got to run around trying to act like you're not inferior. That's a tough job. It's a very tough job. And I suffered from it until I got to college. And in college, everybody was drinking. I was going to hold off drinking because I grew up in the Catholic Church. And there was, if I remember, if you held off drinking until you were 21, you got something like 200,000 years off in purgatory. And as I kept track of my own sins, I had already exceeded that. I mean, I was, as soon as my brain started working, it worked on sin. Just, let's think of something sinful. And so I said, well, no, we're not going to drink till we're 21. But I'm at the university, and my roommates and everybody, they're going, what are you doing? You're in college, and you're not drinking. This is when you drink, when you're in college. And I said, well, I'll get around to it, but not yet. I'm not going to do it yet. And there came a night when the dean of the freshmen had typed up a list of 30 people. My name was on the list, and I was to go in this room on the old campus and meet these other 20 guys. Meet and greet. Get to know everyone. Go up and say hello to everyone. I'd rather go into combat than to do that. But I couldn't get out of it, so I went. And on the way in, I decided, let's be brave tonight. Let's just walk up and say hello to people. You can do it. Can you imagine cheering yourself on to say hello? It's ridiculous. But I got there and I looked around trying to figure out where I was going to start, because they had already divided up into about five groups. And I said, that one looks friendly over there. So I started over, and they all turned and looked at me, and with their eyes, they said, we don't want to know you. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to upset you. I'm actually going to this group over here. And as I glanced at them, they had the same look in their eye. You know how you can talk with your eyes? And they said, this group is already big enough. We don't need anybody else in this group. And I went around and looked at every group and gave up. I said, well, that's that. So I went back to the door that I came in, and there was a bartender, and he had a little bar set up with whiskey and stuff. So I said, tonight's the night. What the hell? I might as well have a drink here. So I went over and ordered scotch and soda. I had heard somebody else order one. And I drank it down, and I sat there waiting to feel good. And nothing happened. I just poured it down. I'm waiting. So I got another one. And I'm waiting to feel good. And I didn't. I said, let's take quite a bit of this stuff. So I got a third one, and I got about half of it down, and I said, this stuff is vastly overrated. I don't feel a damn thing. And I was getting ready to leave, and I looked again at the room. Everyone in the room wanted to know me. I couldn't believe it. All the groups were going, please join our group, please join our group, please. We'd give anything to know you. And I'm going, really? So alcohol didn't really change me, but it sure changed the world that I lived in. It was just amazing. So I started over to the first group, and on the way over, I had the feeling that they really would be lucky to know me. So you can see my perception of the world, of me, of everything, changed like that. Well, I went around and met everyone. Just went and met everyone. I had something to say about everything, whatever state they were from. And then they started going home, and I'm going, wait, we're just getting started here, guys. What are you? And they said, no, we got to study. What do you want to study for? Stay here. This is it. And they all went home. So I went back up to the bartender, and I was thinking to myself, boy, if 3 drinks did that, what would 20 drinks do? Just out of... So I had that a great experience of drinking way more than I could handle and going back. And I spent most of the night in the bathroom lying on the floor next to the toilet. And I was to know that well as the years went on. A lot of us spend a lot of time in there. And when I got up the next morning, I was sitting on the edge of the bed and I thought I was going to die. I felt like I had a hatchet in my head. And it was just splitting. And the thought occurred to me. I said, well, you're going to drink again tonight? And it was a millisecond. And I said, of course I am. I said, this hatchet in my head and this puking and dying is a small price to pay for what happened to me last night. That's why I'm an alcoholic. Alcohol did things for me. Not to me, for me, that it doesn't do for non-alcoholics. It solved all my problems. It gave me answers. I could trust it. It was the most amazing friend that I could ever have. And so I just threw my hat into the drinking crowd and almost didn't graduate. That's how important drinking became. I got into fraternities. I got into anything that had to do with drinking. And my grades started suffering immediately. I was doing pretty good, actually. But when you're going to choose drinking over studying on a consistent basis, you're not going to get very high grades. And so I found myself switching courses to ones that I had a better shot of passing that weren't going to help me in my life at all. And I don't know if you all did that, but I ended up taking a bunch of junk. And one of them was languages. For some unknown reason, even drunk, I could learn a new language. So I studied a lot of Spanish. Now, all these years later, I know Los Angeles. That's the end of my... That's my big Spanish deal. But I will tell you one thing about the... I had a full professor from Cuba. His name was Jose Arom. And the Castro thing was starting up. And I'll never forget this guy. He came up to us and he said, listen, I grew up in Cuba. I know the country as well as anybody in the world. And I can personally guarantee you that it'll never go communist. And I often wish I could run into him so that I could go, well, I think you missed that one by a little bit. Halfway through my college years, the Korean War broke out. And they had a draft for that that really was quite inclusive. And so a couple of friends of mine, we were sitting around drinking beer in our senior year, and one of them said, why don't we go down and join the Marine Corps? Because then we get to choose which branch we're going to go in. And I thought that was the greatest idea. I said, yeah, geez, that's wonderful. So four of us went down to the recruiting office, and they were so delighted to see us. Half drunk, willing to sign anything. Oh, that's fine with me. Whatever you want, I'll do that. And so I graduated and sat around waiting for orders, and they came probably in October of that year. And I found myself on the train going down to join the Marine Corps, and I looked at the brochures from the various Marine bases, and they all had golf courses. And I kind of pictured myself playing golf, really enjoying being in the Marine Corps. And we got to Washington, D.C. That's funny, this story, I forgot about it. But that summer, the Marine Corps down at Parris Island had beat a guy up and he died. You know, the drill sergeants were being a little enthusiastic. And it really upset Congress. They didn't want that happening. So they called the commandant in and they chewed him out. Said, we don't want any more of that happening. There won't be any beating up. You will not put your hands on the recruits. And I don't think I had read it that much, but one of the guys that was going down on the train with us was this little guy, and he was well versed on everything. So he started coaching us. He said, we don't have to take any of this stuff from these guys. I said, they can't touch us. That's the new thing. And when we get there, I'm going to explain it to them. I'm going to go up and tell them about it. So I was going, that's, I like this guy. You know what I mean? So he got out of there and he came on the, we got off on the train deck, the train station platform, and there was a E7, a black gunnery sergeant, black guy with one of the Smokey the Bear hats, and he started yelling at everybody. Why you guys never? And this guy walked up to him and he started pointing at him. I know my rights. I know what the new thing is. You can't go. You got in front. And this guy decked him. He just hit him. And they came down and carried him off on the stretcher. And we never saw him again. Boy, were we... We were in a new position. And I'll be damned. I mean, it was, you know, the stuff you go through is, it's amazing. But it does strip you of your own personality and transform you into a Marine, so that's where your loyalty lies and where you got a cause that's bigger than you. Kind of reminds me of AA. We got something here that's bigger than us individually, and we're all willing to compromise. Well, I want it done this way, but if the majority votes that way, I'm going to go along, which is very important in this program. But anyway, after about 5 weeks, I was standing in line next to one of the Quonset huts where they had the office in there. And here's this Sergeant E5 typing. It was the guy from the railroad train. He had dressed up in civilian clothes and gone up to the Washington, D.C. and got on the train with us. And the whole thing was a show. Do you follow what I'm saying? Yeah. They really didn't hit him. But it worked like a charm. So... Now, when you're going through something like that, you don't drink very much because they don't let you out. And besides, if you did drink, they were going to really cause you a lot of trouble. So for that amount of time, I got in great shape, and I hadn't had a drink in 10 weeks, and we were sent out for 6 months of training to become an infantry officer. And during that time, the drinking was allowed, and I just got, I almost didn't make it through that damn school because drinking came back. But I did make it through, and at the end, there was a movie about pilots. I'd never been in a plane, and I saw this movie, and I suddenly said, those guys don't sleep in foxholes, I can see that. They've got a much better deal. So I signed up for flight school, and this major came up and said, you don't want to do that, you got to serve 2 more years. I said, no, that looks very good. And I passed all the physicals, and I got orders to Pensacola. And I always said, when I grew up in Connecticut, and I saw pictures of palm trees, and I tell you, I knew I wanted to live where the palm trees were. And I was right. I really love being in this type of climate. And I met this wonderful woman. We got married. We honeymooned in New York, and then we flew down to Pensacola. And I got airsick on the plane going to Atlanta. It was the old propeller planes. And I got airsick in Pensacola for the first 5 flights in the old SNJ. But then that went away, the motion sickness. And I did very well. As I went through each phase, I would be number 2 or 3 in the class. And we went through gunnery and formation and knife flying and go to board the carrier, all those things. And then we went down to Texas and we got into jets. And that took about 3 more months. And then we got our wings and the war was over. And I had orders to Japan for a frontline fighter squadron. And so when we got over there, it was, we did a lot of training, and we did a lot of that, but it was a lot of drinking. Everybody in the squadron seemed to me to be a heavy drinker. And the reason I say that is, at happy hour, the colonel would order the drinks. He'd call the waiter over and go, let's have another round. Now, you know when you're in that situation and you're an alcoholic, you have to, they don't drink anywhere near as fast as you. So you have to excuse yourself and go to the bathroom and then stop by the bartender. Could I have a double scotch and you drink it down. Then you come back and go, who's ready for another round? I am. These guys drank fast enough that I didn't have to do that. Now, that's a good crowd to be in. It was. And so I had a lot of great flying, a lot of getting in trouble and all of that. But one day the maintenance officer called me aside and he said, you know, I'm going to be a lieutenant colonel pretty soon and I'd like to get a squadron of really good pilots. And I'd really like you to be in there, but I wouldn't let you drink. And I remember thinking to myself, what the hell is he talking about? I get drunk with him, I get drunk with... I didn't ask him why. I didn't really want to know. And so it wasn't until I got to AA that I realized alcoholics frighten heavy drinkers. Our drinking has something with it that's more intense. It's just, it frightens them. And I didn't realize that. Well, we ended up having 6 children. I had a wonderful assignments all over. But my drinking finally cost me my career. It came time to be promoted to major. And what happens when that happens is you're in the zone. of eligibility. And I had joined AA. I had found AA. And my past caught up to me. My sponsor and I both were in this same zone. And the first year, neither one of us made it. Now you have 2 years. If you don't make it the second year, you quietly leave the Marine Corps. You just leave. And the second year, he made it, and I didn't. And I'm going to tell you, I was a big complainer at the AA meetings after that happened. I was so upset. I went to a meeting every night for 2 years, and I get thrown out of the Marine Corps. Now, is that what AA is all about? Is that what these steps are all about? I thought good things were supposed to happen. So I'm at the meetings, and they're going, "Has anybody got a topic?" "Yeah." Getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. And the leader said, "Sandy, that's not a good topic." Everybody goes, "Yeah, it is." Okay. Getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. Now, this is what I expected to hear from my friends in AA. "Oh, you're available for a job? I have a large corporation. I'd like a guy like you. How about $60,000 a year? You got your own car. And we'll take good care of you." No, I didn't hear any of that. Nobody said anything. One person said, "Double up on your meetings. You're going to have a lot of time on your hands." Another guy said, "Say the serenity prayer. It'll make you feel good." Another guy said, "Go help other people. Take your mind off yourself." And then the last guy said, "The prayer of St. Francis." St. Francis was a Marine, and he gave up everything. So I got home, and I went, "I don't think I explained myself very good to the people for them to come up with stupid answers like that. And just double up on meetings." Well, eventually I got a job and started succeeding. I was in real estate. And then everything went bad. Nobody had any money to loan, and I'm getting ready to declare bankruptcy after all these years. That upset me so much that I decided to bring it up at the meeting. I said, "I'd like to bring up bankruptcy." And they said, "Sandy, that's just not a good thing." "I don't care if it's not a good topic. I'm going to bring it up. I want to get some feedback." Like, "How much money do you need?" You know, that's what I thought I'd hear from somebody in the group. And they said, "Well, if you're going through bankruptcy, then you better double up on your meetings because you've got a lot of time. And say the serenity prayer so that you can stay calm while you're going through bankruptcy. Go help another person. Take your mind off of yourself. And say the prayer of St. Francis because he took a vow of poverty." So I went, what the hell's wrong with AA when you really need them? You get no help whatsoever. You get people saying this crap. And then came a divorce. And I bring it up again. I said, "Well, I want to." It was the same thing. Only St. Francis took a vow of chastity. So that was the only difference. So my point in telling that is to say, no matter what your problem is, the AA solution is the same. It's exactly the same. It is to surrender to a loving God who will carry you through whatever you face. And it sounds funny to say there's just one solution for all problems. But when you think about before we came to AA, what was your solution to every problem? Have a drink. Have a drink. And the same thing in the bar. If somebody came in with a problem, oh my God, I just found out I got cancer. Let me buy you a drink. Just found out my wife is leaving me. Let me buy you a drink. So there was one solution for all problems. And I remember one time getting a summons or warrant or some legal document in the mail. And I said, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. I've never had one of these before. So I have no idea what to do, but I will know shortly, because I went out to the kitchen and I took down the bottle and I took three or four drinks and waited. I said, ah, it's very clear. Just tear it up and throw it away. So you can see the great decision-making power of alcohol. So if you're new, and I've tried to, I didn't get to talk about AA that much, but it really is the easier, softer way. AA is. It's going to enable us to establish personal contact with our own Creator. And the contact itself gives us great peace of mind. And when you already have peace of mind, there's nothing for alcohol to fix. So it's real easy to stay sober. If you're already happy, you're not sitting around about what do I need to do in order to get happy? And then you come up with a plan and nobody will let you do it because they are doing their plan and they're getting in your way. So not only do we get the guidance and the comfort from this power, but we get His help carrying it out. It's the most amazing thing. I tell people, if you have a serious problem, conduct this experiment. Go to the movies. Does that sound like a solution to serious problems? Well, that's my suggestion. You go to the movie, you pick one that you want to see, and you go and you look at the ticket and you see how many hours it runs. And you go out and you say, God, I'm going to be in the movie. Would you watch everything while I'm in there? Would you just take care of everything while I'm in there? And then really let Him hand it over. And see if you can just attend the movie and enjoy it. And just take it all in. Like a guy with no problems. I'm just sitting here. That was a hell of a movie. So then you come out and you say to God, okay, I'll take it back. And when you take it back, it's like it isn't as serious as it was when you turned it over. And you have some ideas as to what direction you ought to take that seem to come out of the blue. It's called an intuition. And that's the level that we want to live at. That's the place we want to go, which is we don't directly come up with the plan for our life or the answer to problems. We totally rely on this new level of existence called the intuitive level. And it's the most amazing thing in the world. The problem is, and I'll close with this, my ego doesn't like that, even though it's a wonderful solution and it works all the time. because I get no credit for this. Do you follow what I'm saying? I said, hey, God, would you figure this out? God figures it out. Would you give me the energy to do it? God gives me the energy. So I can't walk around saying, I accomplished something here. I have to give God all the credit all the time. And there's something about the human beings who don't like that. They want to be in charge of some part of their life and keep God out of it. And that's the hysterical part of our 12-step program, is that we have a perfectly wonderful solution and we agree that it works and we decide not to use it most of the time. God, I'll get back to you. I'm going to handle this one myself. And then you get a call. You have to call your sponsor. He said, what'd you do? You handle the problem yourself? Yeah. I decided to take it over. So if you're new and you can remember let go and let God, you've captured the whole program. Thank you all very much.